Bob, let's look at how this situation developed, because it sure started out simply enough.
Yes, it did, Bob. The pilot elected to return to the ramp to pick up the luggage that he inadvertently left at the FBO. And in doing so, he shut down his airplane and restarted. And this could introduce some problems right there, the shutdown and restart. And apparently hustled out to the takeoff point and chose not to do another startup checklist and pre-takeoff checklist, which would have likely detected a problem in the electrical system if he had gone through the checklist sequence.
And isn't this very, you know, human? Because I think this is the one thing we have to realize, that all pilots are human. None of us are perfect. And the human emotions here, you get frustrated. We make a mistake. Human beings get frustrated. And then you try to make up for lost time here. The tower is closing. You've lost your clearance. Next thing you know, you're in the catch-up mode.
Right. It was self-created time pressure on the part of the pilot. He rationalized that he had already done the startup checklist and the pre-takeoff checklist, and what could have changed? Well, who knows what changed, what circuit breakers may have popped or what switches may not be properly positioned. The fact of the matter is a startup checklist should be done on startup, and a pre-takeoff checklist should be done in the run-up area prior to takeoff. And this pilot, because of time pressures and perhaps frustration, as you described, chose to skip those steps.
You know, there's a right way and a wrong way to do things in an airplane. And we all know what the right way is to do it, but can't we always rationalize that shortcut?
Especially if we've just done it 10 minutes ago. Here the pilot is now behind schedule, so he wants to try to make up that time. You can imagine that situation. And that's what causes us to make the shortcuts, when we get behind and we start to push. But the fact is, we need to do it the same way every time.
And John, you know, once again, with the tower shutting down here, wow, I mean, have we created a little problem or a big problem by losing our clearance as this scenario, you know, unfolds?
Sure. Plus, you have that emotional thing where it's like, darn it, now, because maybe it wasn't even my fault that I left the luggage back there, but somebody else screwed me up. So now I got to go back and catch up again, where before I had been in the system, I had been in the safety net, I knew exactly how to do it, I knew that clearance delivery had given me the clearance, and I know all the steps after that. Now, because of some other outside event that's messed up my flow here, my flow is all messed, now I got to kind of make it up as I'm going along. I don't really know how to do this call on the ground kind of thing or something, so I'll call them in the air and I'll catch up as we go along, because I haven't thought through all the possible steps there. And all of a sudden, you're in a situation now where you've broken that consistency. And a lot of things that we do in aviation rely on that consistency. We do the same checklist every time, and our clearances come in the same order. All that stuff is based on consistency, and we've broken that now. And it only takes one little piece to break it.
And let's look at where the pressure came from. Is the pressure external or internal, Bob?
I think it's self-created pressure.
Absolutely.
Myself. Sure. There's no reason this pilot couldn't have done another startup checklist, another pre-takeoff checklist, and perhaps detected this problem and not caused this thing to unravel the way it did.
Quite frankly, how long would it have taken to do it right? Maybe 5 minutes? I mean, can we invest 5 minutes in ourselves to run the checklist we need, maybe to make a phone call, pick up our clearance on the telephone so that we're in the IFR system now? Big deal, not a big deal. I'll take off VFR. How many times have you heard pilots say that? We'll take off VFR, get our clearance in the air. It's almost a standard comment.
That may have been another rationalization, Bob. As John mentioned, perhaps this pilot wasn't quite sure how to obtain the release on the ground, who to call, or how to go about doing that.
Because there is different phraseology and everything, but go back to what you were saying is, I think in any time that we're in a situation where we feel that the snowball's rolling further ahead than we are, it's time to take that time out to hit that reset button to do whatever we got to do. And the time to do that is on the ground. A little brief story. I remember back when I used to ride jump seats a lot. I was in an airliner that had all sorts of mechanical problems at the gate. There was mechanics in and out. Everybody's all over the cockpit. They had to refuel. They had a whole bunch of things to do. And finally, when it was all done, the captain closed the door and said, "You know what? We're starting over from the very beginning. We're going to take our first flight of the day checklist, every switch, every circuit breaker, I'm checking everything because there's just been too many people in this cockpit. There's been too many things going wrong. We're going to start all over again from scratch. Yeah. And I said, you know what? It's going to take him 5 minutes more, but I applauded him for that.
We have to recognize the disruptive influence that this has had. Not a big event, not a catastrophic event, but it was a disruption. And we all know from our experience that every gear-up landing is preceded by an interruption, a distraction.
Exactly.
And this guy's still on the ground, so he's not going to make a gear-up landing. But we go from being ahead of the airplane to behind the airplane. And when this guy took off, he was mentally behind the airplane, chasing it. He had every reason to believe he's going to catch up with the airplane. The airplane's doing just fine. You know, it's nighttime. The airplane doesn't know it's nighttime. The airplane doesn't know that I'm frustrated. The airplane's doing good. Well, the next thing you know, the airplane's not doing so good. So let's transition now from where this guy has really gotten himself in a pickle. All of a sudden, he is not able to talk to anybody. He's got an electrical failure, and he's in the clouds at night. Bob, how close are we to a catastrophic situation here?
Very close, very close. Being in the clouds at night without electrical power, that is about as serious a situation as you can get.
He's about one more distraction from dying.
That's right.
And I think unless you've been there, it's really hard to mentally create this situation. And that's why we really have to stress just how serious this is, because right now your mind is racing, it's night, you're in the weather, you have no instruments to feed off of. Vertigo disorientation is a huge player because all you have right now is your inner ear, and your inner ear is lying to you. You reach for a flashlight, it may be the last thing you ever do.
Mm-hmm. And that was a point that Bob brought up in his analysis, that having the flashlight in the airplane is one thing, but being able to get to it without turning your head and reaching in the back seat or bending over and picking it up from the floor is an excellent point.
And certainly you have to hope the flashlight will work once you locate it and turn it on.
Yeah,
and know what to do with it, too, because you've only got two hands.
Yes,
so,
yes.
And that's why a lot of people use these headlamps or, you know, visor clips, and there's a million different products out there. But how many times have you ever actually practiced doing that, turn off the panel lights and try and fly with just a flashlight?
How do you hold a flashlight?
Yeah.
Where do you put it?
Or what instrument do you shine it on at what phase of flight? Because
so,
it's...
You may have a flashlight that's perfectly serviceable, but if you can't use the flashlight in flight, it's still not going to serve your purposes.
Or practice.
You're right. I've seen the visor lights, and those are really kind of cool,
mm-hmm.
provided batteries in those work.
Yeah.
Single pilot IFR, organizing the cockpit. Is everything where I need it? I mean, how often do we use our flashlight in general aviation, okay? A, are the batteries good? Do I have backup batteries? Is it reachable? I can't emphasize enough how vital head movements are at night with the inner ear, the makeup of the inner ear. You're inducing movement to the inner ear that's just going to set up vertigo. The remedy for vertigo is transitioning to your instruments.
Uh-huh.
It's night and you don't have any lights in the cockpit. What are you going to transition to? So avoidance is the real key here. Don't go into the clouds at night, you know, without your lights. But here we are. Your next step has to be very thoughtful, very, very deliberate while your mind is racing and your heart is beating off the charts.
Commonplace to find flashlights is in a flight bag. Commonplace to find the flight bag is on the rear seats. Now, what's this require? This requires that the pilot rotate his body and his head and look into the back seat and then turn once he finds the flashlight. You're just, as you described, Bob, you're just setting yourself up for vertigo.
Your first step may be to take a deep breath and really, really think about, you know, what you have, what you don't have. Much easier said than done in a panic situation for a general aviation pilot who has never experienced this situation before. And you really, really have to slow down and think about what you got. Right now, it's an unhappy situation, but it's not dangerous until, you know, you do something with the airplane from which you may not be able to recover.
Yep. Common tendency would be to try to do a quick 180 and get out of there.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And a quick 180 lends itself to a way steeper bank than you need to be making at that point in time, and especially if you haven't really settled down on flying instruments yet.
You bet. You know, Bob, you started off this whole discussion with talking about, you know, how much planning and preparation is required for a night IFR flight. So, yeah, you know, why are you taking off, you know, at night? when, you know, a half hour before the tower closes, well, all of these are wonderful things, and we won't revisit them because it's now too late, and let's deal with where we are rather than what we should have done. But based upon where we are now, okay, if you don't slow down and take a deep breath, you know, you may not have to worry about your second step. But, you know, Bob, okay, you've taken a deep breath. You know, you're in the airplane at night in the cloud. Ooh, how do we get back to a safe scenario or a track that gets us back to safety?
Well, first, we need to inventory what we have. We've got a GPS which is working, which has an independent battery. Unknown at this point what the charge level is in that battery. Secondly, we have a flashlight. Our first priority is to illuminate the panel and get the airplane under control. And as you say, take a deep breath and plan our next move. I think the next move, as I described in the response, is to re-achieve VFR conditions as quickly and as reasonably as possible. Then land the airplane at the first suitable airport. You don't want to continue to fly relying upon that GPS battery. That could last you 6 hours. It could be only good for an hour. So you really don't want to press on relying upon that battery or your flashlight batteries for that matter. Now, in this case, we're heading away from the high terrain, heading up towards Oceanside, and the route for this flight takes us along the coast. So high terrain is not that much of a concern right now. We know we've just flown into the clouds inadvertently, so we must be close to VFR conditions. Let's get back to VFR conditions, and let's not dig ourselves any deeper hole than we are already in.
Don't forget, you've launched into some pretty sophisticated airspace there with a number of Class Bs around and lots of airliners and perhaps military fighters flying around. And they certainly don't, well, ATC may or may not be protecting some airspace. We don't know what they can see right now. Certainly, we don't need to be up there mixing it up with that traffic and creating a hazard for.
But there certainly is a collision hazard, a potential collision hazard.
Yeah. Right.
Question of how severe that is, but the fact that it exists at all means we have to react to that.
You're right, way better off VFR.
And, yeah, no transponder, no position lights, no landing light. You're in imminent danger to other aircraft.
You are a hazard, clearly a hazard.
That really brings up, and it's a good point, you know, situational awareness. You know, you have terrain, you have other aircraft, and all of that impacts, you know, your situation and how you're going to deal with this situation. So we always need to know where we are, what around us may create additional problems, you know, and really, real, real busy area. This is not northern Idaho where, you know, you're the only airplane, you know, within 50 miles. A lot of airplanes in the San Diego area, and they're all out. And ATC can't help you here because they can't hear you, they can't see you, and it really creates a real dangerous situation that you as the pilot in command have to take responsibility for.
And it's important to note that even the very sophisticated airplanes with TCAS can't see you. You do not have an operating transponder.
Right. Yep. Absolutely.
ATC may or may not have seen you come off. We talked a little bit in the setup about there was possibly a garbled transmission, possibly some radar contact, possibly not. All of this is really just kind of supposing that they've seen this, but none of it you can depend upon that they will protect you, they will protect the airspace for you, or even realize which target you are. So you really have to assume that you're on your own and you're going to have to figure this out as you go along. You have no backup.
There could be other primary targets out there.
Could be.
Which is going to further confuse the issue.
Right.
Let's remember the priorities in any emergency and, you know, no questions that this is an emergency. Number one, maintain aircraft control. Mm-hmm. If you don't do that, you know, our discussion ends very, very rapidly. But once you have the airplane under control, you know, smoothly transition to the fact that, okay, we don't want to do anything to create vertigo or induce vertigo. We really need to run a checklist here because we might be able to get this airplane operating the way we'd like it to operate. And what's the most important step with regard to that? I mean, you flipped the master switch. Well, okay, that's cool. But you know what? There's something that really needs to be done here. Bob, take us through what needs to be done inside the cockpit to get the airplane back.
You need to follow the emergency checklist for electrical failure, whatever that might be for your airplane. Most cases, it involves more than just flicking the master switch off and on. Most systems have two circuit breakers involved. You need to know where they're located and what the procedure is for resetting the alternator. So you need to look at that. You may have popped a circuit breaker. It may have been of no real consequence, and the checklist may allow resetting it. But you need to know what that system is comprised of and how to deal with it. And that would be in your emergency checklist in Section 3 of your POH.
And follow it without shortcutting. You got to start at the beginning. If it says turn everything off and then pull the breaker, reset it, whatever it is, you got to do it step by step, and you can't shortcut it. We've already shortcut once already on this trip, and you see where that got us.
And another question, where's the checklist?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you a story about checklists. This is some years ago in a Cessna 182RG, and was doing training, and we came back to the airport and put the gear down. The gear didn't come down. No light. So I've flown these Cessnas for years, and I have all sorts of gear problems, as many of you have had. I said to the pilot, I guess we got a problem here. What are you going to do about it? Pilot thought it over and said, well, you think we should get the checklist out? I said, probably a good idea. And the pilot says, the POH is in the box of miscellaneous items in the baggage compartment under the back.
Absolutely.
So absolutely no use in this case.
That's planning, preparation, and forethought. That in this case here, it's too late. Reaching for a checklist. A lot of times we'll keep it in the pocket over on the passenger side. Can you reach that from the pilot seat? Maybe, maybe not. But trying to do it at night in the weather will kill you.
Each make and model aircraft has their own unique alternator reset procedure.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not just one procedure that works for everything. And flipping the master switch off and on may be the right procedure. It may not be for this airplane. But you need to know that procedure for the airplane you're flying it, especially if you intend to fly that airplane night IFR. Another point, Bob, that you made earlier was flipping the master switch off and on probably shut off the handheld GPS. And now he's got to wait for that to boot back up.
It may.
So
it may.
Quick action isn't necessarily the correct action.
And a lot of folks may be inclined to say, all right, I'm going to stay on instruments with the portable GPS, fly back, shoot an instrument approach, get on the ground. What do you think about that, and what are some of the drawbacks to that argument?
Well, I think you're designing your own instrument approach. While it's possible to put the various sequential fixes of an instrument approach into that GPS, it really isn't a legitimate approach. In an emergency, it's probably better than nothing. But again, you're going to assume that you're going to fly to the initial approach fix of whatever approach you select and remain in the clouds perhaps for that period of time, and that your GPS battery is going to hold out in the meantime. That could be 20 minutes to accomplish this. It could be half an hour. It could take you 10 minutes to get organized and get the fixes in there before you can even proceed to the initial approach fix to start this self-created approach. All of that time, you're operating on your GPS battery. And remember, you're trying to do all of this, refer to an approach plate, pick out the names of the fixes that you will need, and construct this GPS approach in your handheld while you're flying via a flashlight. So it's a pretty tough thing to do.
In complex airspace.
Complex airspace, no less, yes.
One thing that's required here, too, is the situational awareness and the terrain awareness. There may be a time when you can't safely descend out of that last altitude that you are because of terrain or obstacles or something, and you may have to actually rely on some sort of quasi-approach that you've made up out of that before you can navigate to a point where you can safely descend.
I think that is possible, but I would put that as a last resort to do that, yes.
It really points out the classic sequence of events, but we all know that every accident that we study is just that, a sequence of events that takes us to the accident scene. And in this case here, it's easy to look back and see all the mistakes that were made, but as we're going through them, none of them leap out as being, boy, that was a really dumb thing to do. A bunch of subtleties that play into this, okay? Your decision to take off at night versus daytime. Daytime, nighttime, this is a very, very different scenario. Okay, you forget a bag. Okay, that's human. But once you forget that bag, as John said before, okay, getting back to a normal sequence of events as opposed to playing hurry up, playing catch up. You know, you've lost your clearance, you've lost your sequence, you've lost your flow, you've lost your mental readiness, you know, to deal with this flight. And so we just start getting further and further behind, and the next thing you know, here we are facing a very, very catastrophic situation, IMC at night, with no lights, and the fact that you're a heartbeat away from losing control of your airplane and really creating a real, real dangerous situation. So it shows how quickly we can go from option normal to hell in a handbasket. But we as the pilot in command, you know, need to grab that and really manage that situation. And I think that's what happened here is the pilot will let the situation control him versus he controlling the situation.